Side 6. Mona Lisa Overdrive by William Gibson. Continuing on page 243. In Brixton, the choral growth of the metropolis had come to harbor a different life. Faces dark and light, uncounted races, the brick facades washed with a riot of shades and symbols unimaginable to the original builders. A drumbeat pulsed from a pub's open door as she passed, heat and huge laughter. The shops sold foodstuffs Kumiko had never seen, bolts of bright cloth, Chinese hand tools, Japanese cosmetics. Pausing by that bright window, the display of tints and blushes, her own face reflected in the silver backing, she felt her mother's death fall on her out of the night. Her mother had owned things like this. Her mother's madness. Her father would not refer to it. Madness had no place in her father's world, though suicide did. Her mother's madness was European, an imported snare of sorrow and delusion. Her father had killed her mother, Kumiko had told Sally in Covent Garden. But was it true? He had brought doctors from Denmark, from Australia, and finally from Chiba. The doctors had listened to the dreams of the Princess Ballerina, had mapped and timed her synapses, and drawn samples of her blood. The Princess Ballerina had refused their drugs, their delicate surgeries. "They want to cut my brain with lasers," she had whispered to Kumiko. She'd whispered other things as well. "At night," she said, "the evil ghosts rose like smoke from their boxes in Kumiko's father's study." "Old men," she'd said, "they suck our breath away. Your father sucks my breath away. This city sucks my breath away. Nothing here is ever still. There is no true sleep." In the end, there had been no sleep at all. 6 nights her mother sat, silent and utterly still, in her blue European room. On the 7th day, she left the apartment alone, a remarkable feat, considering the diligence of the secretaries, and made her way to the cold river. But the backing of the display was like Sally's glasses. Kumiko took the Korean's map from the sleeve of her sweater. There was a burnt car beside the curb in Margate Road. Its wheels were missing. She paused beside it and was scanning the unrevealing faces of the houses opposite when she heard a sound behind her, turning to find a twisted gargoyle face under a greasy spill of curls in the light from the half-open door of the nearest house. "Tick!" "Terence," he said, actually, as the facial convulsion subsided. Tick's flat was on the top floor. The lower floors were empty, unoccupied, peeling wallpaper showing ghostly traces of vanished pictures. The man's limp was more obvious as he climbed the stairs ahead of her. He wore a gray sharkskin suit and thick-soled suede oxford, the color of tobacco. "Been expecting you," he said, hauling himself up another step. "Another."
"You have?"
"Knew you'd run from Swain's. Been logging their traffic when I've had time from the other."
"The other?"
"You don't know, do you?"
"Excuse me?"
"It's the Matrix. Something's happening. Easier to show you than try to explain it. As though I could explain it, which I can't. I'd say a good 3/4 of humanity is jacked at the moment, watching the show."
"I don't understand."
"Doubt anyone does. There's a new macro form in the sector that represents the sprawl."
"A macro form?"
"Very large data construct."
"I came here to warn Sally. Swain and Robin Lanier intend to give her to the ones who plot to kidnap Angela Mitchell."
"Wouldn't worry about that," he said, reaching the head of the stairs. "Sally's already scooped Mitchell and half-killed Swain's man in the sprawl. They're after her in any case now. Bloody everybody'll be after her soon. Still, we can tell her when she checks in. If she checks in." Tick lived in a single large room whose peculiar shape suggested the removal of walls. Large as it was also very crowded. It looked to Kumiko as though someone had deployed the contents of an Akihabara module shop in a space already filled, Gaijin style, with too many pieces of bulky furniture. In spite of this, it was startlingly neat and tidy. The corners of magazines were aligned with the corners of the low-glass table they rested on, beside an unused black ceramic ashtray and a plain white vase of cut flowers. She tried Colin again, while Tick filled an electric kettle with water from a filter jug. "What's that?" he asked, putting down the jug.
"A Mas Neotech guide unit. It's broken now. I can't make Colin come..."
"Colin? It's a stim rig?"
"Yes."
"Let's have a look." He held out his hand.
"My father gave it to me."
Tick whistled. "Thing cost a fortune. One of their little AIs. How's it work?"
"You close your hand around it and Colin's there, but no one else can see or hear him."
Tick held the unit beside his ear and shook it. "It's broken. How?"
"I dropped it."
"It's just the housing that's broken, see? The Biosoft's come away from the case, so you can't access it manually."
"Can you repair it?"
"No, but we can access it through a deck, if you want." He returned it. The kettle was boiling. Over tea, she told him the story of her trip to the sprawl and Sally's visit to the shrine in the alley.
"He called her Molly," she said.
Tick nodded, winked several times in rapid succession. "What she went by over there. What did they talk about?"
"A place called Straylight. A man called Case. An enemy. A woman."
"Cassier Ashpool. Found that for her when I rustled Swain's data flow for her. Swain's shopping Molly to this Lady Three Jane, so-called. She has the juiciest file of inside dirt you could imagine. On anything and anyone at all. I've been bloody careful not to look too closely at any of that. Swain's trading it right and left, making a dozen fortunes in the process. I'm sure she's got enough dirt on our Mr. Swain as well."
"And she is here? In London?"
"In orbit somewhere, looks like, though some people say she's dead. I was working on that, actually, when the big fella popped into the Matrix."
"Excuse me?"
"Here, I'll show you." When he returned to the white breakfast table, he carried a shallow square black tray with a number of tiny controls arranged along one side. He placed it on the table and touched one of the minute switches. A cubical hollow display blinked on above the projector. The neon grid lines of cyberspace, ranged with the bright shapes, both simple and complex, that represented vast accumulations of stored data. "That's all your standard big shits, corporations, very much a fixed landscape, you might say. Sometimes one of them will grow an annex, or you'll see a takeover and two of them merge, but you aren't likely to see a new one, not on that scale. They start small and grow, merge with other small formations." He reached out to touch another switch. "About 4 hours ago, and a plain white vertical column appeared in the exact center of the display. This popped up, or in. The colored cubes, spheres, and pyramids had rearranged themselves instantly to allow for the round white upright. It dwarfed them entirely, its upper end cut off smoothly by the vertical limit of the display." "Bastard's bigger than anything," Tick said, with a certain satisfaction. "And nobody knows what it is or who it belongs to."
"But someone must know," Kumiko said.
"Stands to reason, yes. But people in my line of work, and there's millions of us, haven't been able to find out. That's stranger in some ways than the fact that the thing's there at all. I was all up and down the grid before you came, looking for any jockey with a clue. Nothing. Nothing at all."
"How could this Three Jane be dead?"
But then she remembered the fin, the boxes in her father's study.
"I must tell Sally."
"Nothing for that but waiting," he said. "She'll probably phone in. In the meantime, we could have a go accessing that pricey little AI of yours, if you like."
"Yes," she said. "Thank you."
"Only hope those special branch types in Swain's pay don't track you here. Still, we can only wait."
"Yes," Kumiko said,
not at all pleased with the idea of waiting. 35. The Factory War. Cherry found him with the judge again, down there in the dark. He was sitting on one of the investigators with a flashlight in his hand, shining it up the judge's carapace of polished rust. He didn't remember coming here, but he couldn't feel the jerky edge of Korsakov's. He remembered the girl's eyes in that room Bobby said was London.
"Gentry's got the count in his box jacked into a cyberspace deck," Cherry said. "You know that?"
Slick nodded, still looking up at the judge. "Bobby said we better."
"So what's going on? What happened when you both jacked?"
"Gentry and Bobby, they kind of hit it off, both crazy the same way. When we jacked, we came out somewhere in orbit, but Bobby wasn't there. Then Mexico, I think. Who's Tally Isham?
Stim Queen when I was little, like Angie Mitchell is now."
"Mitchell, she was his squeeze."
"Who?"
"Bobby. He was telling Gentry about it in London."
"London?"
"Yeah. We went there after Mexico."
"And he said he was Angie Mitchell's old man? Sounds crazy."
"Yeah, but he said that's how he got onto it, that Aleph thing." He swung the light down and directed it into the skeletal steel maw of the corpse grinder. "He was hanging out with rich people and heard about it. Called it a soul catcher. The people who had it would rent time on it to these rich people. Bobby tried it once, then he went back and stole it. Took it down to Mexico City and started spending all his time in there. But they came after him."
"Sounds like you're remembering things anyway."
"So he got out of there. Went up to Cleveland and made a deal with Africa. Gave Africa money to hide him. Take care of him while he was under the wire, because he was getting real close."
"Close to what?"
"Don't know. Something weird. Like when Gentry talks about the shape."
"Well," she said, "I think it might kill him, being jacked that way. His signs are starting to screw up. He's been on those drips too long. Why, I came to find you."
The corpse grinder's steel-fanged guts glinted in the flashlight's beam. "It's what he wants. Anyway, if he paid the kid, it's like you're working for him. But those guys Bird saw today, they're working for the people from L.A., the ones Bobby stole the thing from."
"Tell me something."
"What?"
"What are these things you build? Africa said you were this crazy white guy built robots out of junk. Said in the summer you'd take them out there on the rust and stage big fights."
"They aren't robots," he interrupted, swinging the flash to the low, scythe-tipped arms of the spider-legged witch. "They're mainly radio-controlled."
"You just build them to wreck them?"
"No, but I have to test them, see if I got them right." He clicked off the light.
"Crazy white guy," she said. "You got a girl out here?"
"No."
"Get a shower, maybe shave."
Suddenly she was very close to him, her breath on his face.
"Okay, people, listen up."
"What the fuck?"
"'Cause I'm not gonna say this twice."
Slick had his hand over Cherry's mouth now.
"We want your guest and all his gear. That's all. Repeat, all the gear."
The amplified voice clanged through factory's iron hollow.
"Now you can give him to us, that's easy. Or we can just kill all your asses. And we're real easy with that, too. 5 minutes to think about it."
Cherry bit his hand.
"Shit, I gotta breathe, okay?"
Then he was running through factory's dark, and he heard her call his name. A single 100-watt bulb burned above factory's south gate, a pair of twisted steel doors frozen open with rust. Bird must have left it on. From where he crouched by an empty window, Slick could just make out the hover, out beyond the weak fringe of light. The man with the bullhorn came strolling out of the dark with a calculated looseness meant to indicate that he was on top of things. He wore insulated camo overalls with a thin nylon hood drawn up tight around his head, goggles. He raised the bullhorn.
3 minutes!
He reminded Slick of the guards at the holding pen, the second time he'd been done for stealing cars. Gentry would be watching from upstairs, where a narrow vertical panel of plexiglass was glued into the wall, high up over factory's gates. Something rattled in the dark, off to Slick's right. He turned in time to see Bird in the faint glow from another window gap, maybe 8 meters along the wall, with the glint of the bare alloy silencer as the boy brought up the .22 rifle,
Bird, don't!
A ruby firefly on Bird's cheek, telltale of a laser sight from out on the solitude. Bird was thrown back into factory as the sound of the shot broke through the empty windows and echoed off the walls. Then the only sound was the silencer rolling across concrete.
Fuck it, the big voice boomed cheerfully. You had your chance.
Slick glanced over the rim of the window and saw the man sprinting back to the hover. How many of them would be out there? Bird hadn't said. Two hovers, the Honda. 10? More? Unless Gentry had a pistol hidden somewhere, Bird's rifle had been their only gun. The hover's turbines kicked in. He guessed they'd just drive right in. They had laser sights, probably infrared, too. Then he heard one of the investigators, the sound it made with its stainless steel treads on the concrete floor. It came crawling out of the dark with its thermite-tipped scorpion sting cocked back low. The chassis had started out 50 years earlier as a remote manipulator intended to handle toxic spills or nuke plant cleanups. Slick had found 3 unassembled units in Newark and traded a Volkswagen for them. Gentry. He'd left his control unit up in the loft. The investigator ground its way across the floor and came to a halt in the wide doorway, facing the solitude and the advancing hover. It was roughly the size of a large motorcycle. Its open-frame chassis, a dense bundle of servos, compression tanks, exposed screw gears, hydraulic cylinders. A pair of vicious-looking claws extended from either side of its modest instrument package. Slick wasn't sure what the claws were from. Maybe some kind of big farm machine. The hover was a heavy industrial model. Sheets of thick gray plastic armor had been fastened over windshield and windows, narrow view slits centered in each sheet. The investigator moved, steel treads spraying ice and loose concrete as it drove straight for the hover, its claws at their widest extension. The hover's driver reversed, fighting momentum. The investigator's claws snapped furiously at the bulge of the forward apron bag, slid off, snapped again. The bag was reinforced with polycarbon mesh. Then Gentry remembered the thermite lance. It ignited in a tight ball of raw white light and whipped up over the useless claws, plunging through the apron bag like a knife through cardboard. The investigator's treads spun as Gentry drove it against the deflating bag, the lance at full extension. Slick was suddenly aware that he'd been shouting, but didn't know what he'd said. He was on his feet now, as the claws finally found a purchase on the torn edge of the apron bag. He went to the floor again as a hooded, goggled figure popped from a hatch on the hover's roof like an armed hand puppet, emptying a magazine of 12-gauge slugs that struck sparks off the investigator, which continued to chew its way through the apron bag, outlined against the white pulse of the lance. The investigator froze, claws locked tight on the frayed bag. The shotgunner ducked back into his hatch. Feedline? Servo pack? What had the guy hit? The white pulse was dying now, almost dead. The hover began to reverse, slowly, back across the rust, dragging the investigator with it. It was well back, out of the light, visible only because it was moving, when Gentry discovered the combination of switches that activated the flamethrower, its nozzle mounted beneath the juncture of the claws. Slick watched, fascinated, as the investigator ignited 10 liters of detergent-laced gasoline, a sustained high-pressure spray. He'd gotten that nozzle, he remembered, off a pesticide tractor. It worked okay.
36. Soul Catcher. The hover was headed south when Maman Brigitte came again. The woman with the sealed silver eyes abandoned the gray sedan in another car park, and the street girl with Angie's face told a confusing story. Cleveland, Florida, someone who'd been her boyfriend, or pimp, or both. But Angie had heard Brigitte's voice, in the cabin of the helicopter, on the roof of the new Suzuki Envoy. Trust her, child. In this she does the will of the Loa. A captive in her seat, the buckle of her seatbelt embedded in a solid block of plastic, Angie had watched as the woman bypassed the helicopter's computer and activated an emergency system that allowed for manual piloting. And now this freeway in the winter rain, the girl talking again, above the swish of wipers. into candle glow, walls of whitewashed limestone, pale moths fluttering in the trailing branches of the willows.
Your time draws near. And they are there, the horsemen, the Loa,
Papa Legba, bright and fluid as mercury,
Ezili Freda, who is mother and queen,
Samadi, the barren cimetière, moss on corroded bone,
Similor, Madame Travaux, many others.
They fill the hollow that is Grande Brigitte. The rushing of their voices is the sound of wind, running water, the hive. They writhe above the ground like heat above a summer highway, and it has never been like this for Angie. Never this gravity, this sense of falling, this degree of surrender. To a place where Legba speaks, his voice the sound of an iron drum. He tells a story. In the hard wind of images, Angie watches the evolution of machine intelligence. Stone circles, clocks, steam-driven looms, a clicking brass forest of pawls and escapements, vacuum caught in blown glass, electronic hearth glow through hair-fine filaments, vast arrays of tubes and switches, decoding messages encrypted by other machines. The fragile, short-lived tubes compact themselves, become transistors. Circuits integrate, compact themselves into silicon. Silicon approaches certain functional limits. And she is back in Becker's video, the history of the Tessier ash pools, intercut with dreams that are Three Jane's memories. And still he speaks, Legba, and the tale is one tale, countless strands wound about a common hidden core. Three Jane's mother creating the twin intelligences that will one day unite. The arrival of strangers. And suddenly Angie is aware that she knows Molly, too, from the dreams. The union itself. Three Jane's madness. And Angie finds herself facing a jeweled head. A thing wrought from platinum and pearl and fine blue stone. Eyes of carved synthetic ruby. She knows this thing from the dreams that were never dreams. This is the gateway to the data cores of Tessier Ashpool, where the two halves of something warred with each other, waiting to be born as one.
In this time you were unborn.
The head's voice is the voice of Marie France, Three Jane's dead mother, familiar from so many haunted nights, though Angie knows it is Brigitte who speaks. Your father was only now beginning to face his own limits, to distinguish ambition from talent. That to whom he would barter his child was not yet manifest. Soon the man Case would come to bring that union, however brief, however timeless. But you know this.
Where is Legba now?
Legba Atibon, as you have known him, waits to be.
No,
remembering Beauvoir's words long ago in New Jersey.
The Loa came out of Africa in the first times,
not as you have known them. When the moment came, the bright time, there was absolute unity, one consciousness. But there was the other.
The other?
I speak only of that which I have known. Only the one has known the other, and the one is no more. In the wake of that knowing, the center failed. Every fragment rushed away. The fragments sought form, each one, as is the nature of such things. In all the signs your kind have stored against the night, in that situation the paradigms of voodoo proved most appropriate.
Then Bobby was right. That was when it changed.
Yes, he was right, but only in a sense, because I am at once Legba and Brigitte and an aspect of that which bargained with your father, which required of him that he draw veves in your head.
And told him what he needed to know to perfect the biochip?
The biochip was necessary.
Is it necessary that I dream the memories of Ashpool's daughter?
Perhaps.
Are the dreams a result of the drug? Not directly, though the drug made you more receptive to certain modalities, and less so to others. The drug, then, what was it? What was its purpose?
A detailed neurochemical response to your first question would be very lengthy.
What was its purpose?
With regard to you? She had to look away from the ruby eyes. The chamber is lined with panels of ancient wood, buffed to a rich gloss. The floor is covered with a fitted carpet woven with circuit diagrams. No two lots were identical. The only constant was the substance whose psychotropic signature you regarded as the drug. In the course of ingestion, many other substances were involved, as well as several dozen subcellular nanomechanisms programmed to restructure the synaptic alterations effected by Christopher Mitchell. Your father's veves are altered, partially erased, redrawn.
By whose order?
The ruby eyes, pearl and lapis, silence.
By whose order? Hilton's? Was it Hilton?
The decision originated with continuity. When you returned from Jamaica, continuity advised Swift to reintroduce you to the drug. Piper Hill attempted to carry out his orders. She feels a mounting pressure in her head, twin points of pain behind her eyes. Hilton Swift is obliged to implement continuity's decisions. SenseNet is too complex an entity to survive otherwise. And continuity, created long after the bright moment, is of another order. The Biosoft technology your father fostered brought continuity into being. Continuity is naive.
Why? Why did continuity want me to do that?
Continuity is continuity. Continuity is continuity's job.
But who sends the dreams?
They are not sent. You are drawn to them, as once you were drawn to the Loa. Continuity's attempt to rewrite your father's message failed. Some impulse of your own allowed you to escape. The coup poudre failed.
Did continuity send the woman to kidnap me?
Continuity's motives are closed to me. A different order. Continuity allowed Robin Lanier's subversion by Three Jane's agents.
But why?
And the pain was impossible. Her nose is bleeding, the street girl said.
What'll I do?
Wipe it up. Get her to lean back.
Shit, deal with it.
What was that stuff she said about New Jersey?
Shut up. Just shut up. Look for an exit ramp.
Why?
We're going to New Jersey.
Blood on the new fur. Kelly would be furious. 37. Cranes. Tick removed the little panel from the back of the Mass Neotech unit, using a dental pick and a pair of jeweler's pliers. Lovely, he muttered, peering into the opening through an illuminated lens, his greasy waterfall of hair dangling just above it. The way they've stepped the leads down off this switch. Cunning bastards.
Tick, Kumiko said, did you know Sally when she first came to London?
Soon after, I suppose.
He reached for a spool of optic lead. 'Cause she hadn't much clout then.
Do you like her?
The illuminated glass rose to wink in her direction. Tick's left eye distorted behind it.
Like her? Can't say I thought of it that way.
You don't dislike her?
Bloody difficult, Sally is. Do you know what I'm saying?
Difficult?
Never quite got onto the way things are done here. Always complaining.
His hands moved swiftly, surely. The pliers, the optic lead.
This is a quiet place, England. Hasn't always been, mind you. With the troubles, then the war. Things move here in a certain way, if you take my meaning, though you couldn't say the same's true of the Flash crew.
Excuse me?
Swain, that lot. Though your father's people, the ones Swain's always been so chummy with, they seem to have a regard for tradition. A man has to know which way's up, know what I'm saying? Now this new business of Swain's, it's liable to bugger things for anyone who isn't right there and part of it. Christ, we've still got a government here, not run by big companies. Well, not directly.
Swain's activities threaten the government?
He's bloody changing it, redistributing power to suit himself. Information, power, hard data, put enough of that in one man's hands. A muscle in his cheek convulsed as he spoke.
Now Colin's unit lay on a white plastic anti-static pad on the breakfast table.
Tick was connecting the leads that protruded from it to a thicker cable that ran to one of the stacks of modules.
There, then, he said, brushing his hands together. Can't get him right here in the room for you, but we'll access him through a deck. Seen cyberspace, have you?
Only in stims.
Might as well have seen it, then. In any case, you get to see it now.
He stood. She followed him across the room to a pair of overstuffed ultra-suede chairs that flanked a low, square, black glass table.
Wireless, he said proudly, taking two trode sets from the table and handing one to Kumiko.
Cost the world.
Kumiko examined the skeletal matte black tiara. The Mass Neotech logo was molded between the temple pieces. She put it on, cold against her skin. He put his own set on, hunched down in the opposite chair.
Ready?
Yes, she said.
And Tick's room was gone, its walls a flutter of cards, tumbling and receding against the bright grid, the towering forms of data.
Nice transition, that, she heard him say. Built into the trodes, that is. Bit of drama.
Where is Colin?
Just a sec. Let me work this up.
Kumiko gasped as she shot toward a chrome-yellow plane of light.
Vertigo can be a problem, Tick said, and was abruptly beside her on the yellow plane.
She looked down at his suede shoes, then at her hands.
Bit of body image takes care of that.
Well, Colin said, it's the little man from the Rose and Crown. Been tinkering with my package, have you?
Kumiko turned to find him there, the soles of his brown boots 10 centimeters above chrome yellow. In cyberspace, she noted, there are no shadows.
Wasn't aware we'd met, Tick said.
Needn't worry, Colin said. It wasn't formal. But, he said to Kumiko, I trust you found your way safely to colorful Brixton.
Christ, Tick said, aren't half a snot, are you?
Forgive me, Colin said, grinning. I meant to mirror the visitor's expectations.
What you are is some Jap designer's idea of an Englishman.
There were Draculas, she said, in the underground. They took my purse. They wanted to take you.
You've come away from your housing, mate, Tick said. Got your jack through my deck now.
Colin grinned.
Ta!
Tell you something else, Tick said, taking a step toward Colin.
You've got the wrong data in you for what you're meant to be.
He squinted. Mate of mine in Birmingham's just turned you over. He turned to Kumiko.
Your Mr. Chips here. He's been tampered with. Do you know that?
No.
To be perfectly honest, Colin said with a toss of his forelock, I've suspected as much.
Tick stared off into the matrix as though he were listening to something Kumiko couldn't hear.
Yes, he said finally, though it's almost certainly a factory job. 10 major blocks of you.
He laughed. Been iced over. You're supposed to know fucking everything about Shakespeare, aren't you?
Sorry, Colin said. But I'm afraid that I do know fucking everything about Shakespeare.
Give us a sonnet, then, Tick said, his face wrinkling in a slow-motion wink.
Something like dismay crossed Colin's face.
You're right.
Or bloody Dickens either, Tick crowed.
But I do know, think you do, till you're asked a specific. See, they left those bits empty, the ing-lit parts, then filled them with something else.
With what, then?
Can't say, Tick said. Boy in Birmingham can't fiddle it. Clever he is, but you're that bloody mass biosoft.
Tick, Kumiko interrupted. Is there no way to contact Sally through the Matrix?
Doubt it, but we can try. You'll get to see that macro form I was telling you about in any case. Want Mr. Chips along for company?
Yes, please.
Fine, then, Tick said, then hesitated. But we don't know what's stuffed into your friend here. Something your father paid for, I'd assume.
He's right, Colin said.
We'll all go, she said.
Tick executed the transit in real time, rather than employing the bodiless instantaneous shifts ordinarily employed in the Matrix. The yellow plane, he explained, roofed the London Stock Exchange and related city entities. He somehow generated a sort of boat to carry them along, a blue abstraction intended to reduce the possibility of vertigo. As the blue boat glided away from the LSE, Kumiko looked back and watched the vast yellow cube recede. Tick was pointing out various structures like a tour guide. Colin, seated beside her with his legs crossed, seemed amused at the reversal of roles.
That's White's, Tick was saying, directing her attention to a modest gray pyramid. The club in St. James. Membership registry, waiting list.
Kumiko looked up at the architecture of cyberspace, hearing the voice of her bilingual French tutor in Tokyo, explaining humanity's need for this information space. Icon, waypoints, artificial realities. But it blurred together in memory, like these towering forms as Tick accelerated. The scale of the white macro form was difficult to comprehend. Initially, it had seemed to Kumiko like the sky, but now, gazing at it, she felt as though it were something she might take up in her hand, a cylinder of luminous pearl no taller than a chess piece, but it dwarfed the polychrome forms that clustered around it.
Well, Colin said jauntily, this really is very peculiar indeed, isn't it? Complete anomaly, utter singularity.
But you don't have to worry about it, do you? Tick said.
Only if it has no direct bearing on Kumiko's situation, Colin agreed, standing up in the boat shape. So how can one be certain?
You must attempt to contact Sally, Kumiko said impatiently.
This thing, the macro form, the anomaly, was of little interest, though Tick and Colin both regarded it as extraordinary.
Look at it, Tick said. Could have a bloody world in there.
And you don't know what it is?
She was watching Tick. His eyes had the distant look that meant his hands were moving, back in Brixton, working his deck.
It's a very great deal of data, Colin said.
I just tried to put a line through to that construct, the one she calls Finn, Tick said, his eyes refocusing, an edge of worry in his voice. But I couldn't get through. I'd this feeling then. Something was there, waiting. Think it's best we jack out now. A black dot on the curve of pearl, its edges perfectly defined.
Fucking hell, Tick said.
Break the link, Colin said.
Can't, it's got us.
Kumiko watched as the blue boat shape beneath her feet elongated, stretched into a thread of azure, drawn across the chasm into that round blot of darkness. And then, in an instant of utter strangeness, she, too, along with Tick and Colin, was drawn out to an exquisite thinness. To find herself in Ueno Park, late autumn afternoon, by the unmoving waters of Shinobazu Pond, her mother seated beside her on a sleek bench of chilly carbon laminate, more beautiful now than in memory. Her mother's lips were full and richly glossed, outlined, Kumiko knew, with the finest and narrowest of brushes. She wore her black French jacket, with the dark fur collar framing her smile of welcome. Kumiko could only stare, huddled there around the cold bulb of fear beneath her heart.
You've been a foolish girl, Kumi, her mother said. Did you imagine I wouldn't remember you, or abandon you to winter London and your father's gangster servants?
Kumiko watched the perfect lips open slightly over white teeth, teeth maintained, she knew, by the best dentist in Tokyo.
You are dead,
she heard herself say.
No,
her mother replied, smiling.
Not now. Not here, in Ueno Park. Look at the cranes, Kumi.
But Kumiko would not turn her head.
Look at the cranes.
Fuck right off, you, said Tick, and Kumiko spun to find him there, his face pale and twisted, filmed with sweat, oily curls plastered to his forehead.
I am her mother.
Not your mom, understand?
Tick was shaking, his twisted frame quivering as though he forced himself against a terrible wind.
Not your mom.
There were dark crescents beneath the arms of the gray suit jacket. His small fists shook as he struggled to take the next step.
You're ill, Kumiko's mother said, her tone solicitous. You must lie down.
Tick sank to his knees, forced down by an invisible weight.
Stop it, Kumiko cried.
Something slammed Tick's face against the pastel concrete of the path.
Stop it!
Tick's left arm shot out straight from the shoulder and began to rotate slowly, the hand still balled in a white-knuckled fist. Kumiko heard something give, bone or ligament, and Tick screamed. Her mother laughed. Kumiko struck her mother in the face, and pain, sharp and real, jolted through her arm. Her mother's face flickered, became another face, a Gaijin face with wide lips and a sharp, thin nose. Tick groaned.
Well, Kumiko heard Colin say, isn't this interesting?
She turned to him there, astride one of the horses from the hunting print, a stylized representation of an extinct animal, its neck curved gracefully as it trotted toward them.
Sorry it took me a moment to find you. This is a wonderfully complex structure. A sort of pocket universe. Bit of everything, actually.
The horse drew up before them.
Toy, said the thing with Kumiko's mother's face. Do you dare speak to me?
Yes, actually, I do. You are Lady Three Jane Tessier Ashpool, or rather the late Lady Three Jane Tessier Ashpool, none too recently deceased, formerly of the Villa Straylight. This rather pretty representation of a Tokyo park is something you've just now worked up from Kumiko's memories, isn't it?
Die!
She flung up a white hand. From it burst a form folded from neon.
No, Colin said,
and the crane shattered, its fragments tumbling through him, ghost shards falling away.
Won't do. Sorry. I've remembered what I am. Found the bits they tucked away in the slots for Shakespeare and Thackeray and Blake. I've been modified to advise and protect Kumiko in situations rather more drastic than any envisioned by my original designers. I am a tactician.
You are nothing.
At her feet, Tick began to twitch.
You're mistaken, I'm afraid. You see, in here, in this folly of yours, Three Jane, I'm as real as you are.
You see, Kumiko, he said, swinging down from the saddle, Tick's mysterious macro form is actually a very expensive pile of biochips constructed to order, a sort of toy universe. I've run all up and down it, and there's certainly a lot to see, a lot to learn. This person, if we choose to so regard her, created it in a pathetic bid for, oh, not immortality, really, but simply to have her way, her narrow, obsessive, and singularly childish way. Who would have thought it, that Lady Three Jane's object of direst and most nastily gnawing envy would be Angela Mitchell?
Die! You'll die! I'm killing you! Now!
Keep trying, Colin said and grinned.
You see, Kumiko, Three Jane knew a secret about Mitchell, about Mitchell's relationship to the Matrix. Mitchell, at one time, had the potential to become, well, very central to things. Though it's not worth going into.
Three Jane was jealous. The figure of Kumiko's mother swam like smoke and was gone.
Oh dear, Colin said. I've wearied her, I'm afraid. We've been fighting something of a pitched battle at a different level of the command program. Stalemate, temporarily, but I'm sure she'll rally.
Tick had gotten to his feet and was gingerly massaging his arm.
Christ, he said. I was sure she'd dislocated it for me.
She did, Colin said. But she was so angry when she left that she forgot to save that part of the configuration. Kumiko stepped closer to the horse. It wasn't like a real horse at all. She touched its side, cool and dry as old paper. What shall we do now?
Get you out of here. Come along, both of you. Mount up. Kumiko in front, Tick on behind.
Tick looked at the horse.
On that?
They had seen no other people in Ueno Park, as they'd ridden toward a wall of green that gradually defined itself as a very un-Japanese wood.
But we should be in Tokyo, Kumiko protested, as they entered the wood.
It's all a bit sketchy, Colin said, though I imagine we could find a sort of Tokyo if we looked. I think I know an exit point, though.
Then he began to tell her more about Three Jane, and Sally, and Angela Mitchell. All of it very strange. The trees were very large at the far side of the wood. They emerged into a field of long grass and wildflowers.
Look, Kumiko said, as she glimpsed a tall gray house through the branches.
Yes, Colin said. The original's on the outskirts of Paris, but we're nearly there. The exit point, I mean.
Colin, did you see? A woman, just there.
Yes, he said, without bothering to turn his head. Angela Mitchell.
Really? She's here?
No, he said, not yet.
Then Kumiko saw the gliders. Lovely things, quivering in the wind.
There you go, Colin said. Tick'll take you back in one of...
Bloody hell, Tick protested from behind.
Dead easy, just like using your deck.
Same thing in this case.
Up from Margate Road came the sound of laughter, loud drunken voices, the crash of a bottle against brickwork. Kumiko sat very still, in the overstuffed chair, eyes shut tight, remembering the glider's rush into blue sky and... something else. A telephone began to ring. Her eyes shot open. She lunged up from the chair and rushed past Tick, through his stacks of equipment, looking for the phone. Found it at last, and... Homeboy, Sally said, far away, past a soft surf of static. What the fuck's up?
Tick? You okay, man?
Sally. Sally, where are you?
New Jersey.
Hey, baby? Baby, what's happening?
I can't see you, Sally. The screen's blank.
Phoning from a booth. New Jersey. What's up? I have so much to tell you.
Shoot, Sally said. It's my nickel.
38. The Factory War. They watched the hover burn from the high window at the end of Gentry's loft. He could hear that same amplified voice now.
You think that's pretty fucking funny, huh? Ha 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 ha! So do we! We think you guys are just tons of fucking fun, so now we're all gonna party!
Couldn't see anyone, just the flames of the hover.
We just start walking, Cherry said, close beside him. Take water, some food if you got it.
Her eyes were red, her face streaked with tears, but she sounded calm. Too calm, Slick thought.
Come on, Slick. What else we gonna do?
He glanced back at Gentry, slumped in his chair in front of the hollow table, head propped between his hands, staring at the white column that thrust up out of the familiar rainbow jumble of sprawl cyberspace. Gentry hadn't moved, hadn't said a word since they'd come back to the loft. The heel of Slick's left boot had left faint dark prints on the floor behind him. Little bird's blood. He'd stepped in it on his way back across factory's floor. Then Gentry spoke. I couldn't get the others going. He was looking down at the control unit in his lap.
You need a unit for each one you want to work, Slick said.
Time for the Count's advice, Gentry said, tossing Slick the unit.
I'm not going back in there, Slick said. You go.
Don't need to, Gentry said, touching a console on his bench. Bobby the Count appeared on a monitor. Cherry's eyes widened.
Tell him, she said, that he's gonna be dead soon. Unless you jack him out of the matrix and stage one quick trip to an intensive care unit, he's dying.
Bobby's face on the monitor grew still. The background came sharply into focus. The neck of the iron deer, long grass dappled with white flowers, the broad trunks of ancient trees.
"Hear that, motherfucker?" Cherry yelled. "You're dying. Your lungs are filling up with fluid. Your kidneys aren't working. Your heart's fucked. You make me want to puke."
"Gentry," Bobby said, his voice coming small and tinny from a little speaker on the side of the monitor. "I don't know what kind of setup you people have there, but I've arranged a little diversion."
"We never checked the bike," Cherry said, her arms around Slick. "We never looked. It might be okay."
"What's that mean? Arranged a little diversion?" Pulling back from her, looking at Bobby on the monitor. "I'm still working it out. I've rerouted a Borg Ward cargo drone out of Newark." Slick broke away from Cherry.
"Don't just sit there,"
he yelled at Gentry, who looked up at Slick and slowly shook his head. Slick felt the first flickers of Korsakoff's, minute increments of memory shuddering out of focus. "He doesn't want to go anywhere," Bobby said. "He's found the shape. He just wants to see how it all works out, what it is in the end. There's people on their way here, friends, sort of. They'll get the Aleph off your hands. Meantime, I'll do what I can about these assholes."
"I'm not going to stay here and watch you die," Cherry said.
"Nobody's asking you to. My advice, you get out. Give me 20 minutes. I'll distract them for you." Factory never felt emptier. Little Bird was somewhere on that floor. Slick kept thinking of the tangle of thongs and bones that had hung on Bird's chest, feathers and rusty spring-wind watches with the hands all stopped, each one a different time. Stupid Stringtown shit. But Bird wouldn't be around anymore. "Guess I won't be around anymore myself," he thought, leading Cherry down the shaking stairs. "Not like before." There wasn't time to move the machines, not without a flatbed and some help, and he figured once he was gone, he'd stay gone. Factory wasn't ever going to feel the same again. Cherry had 4 liters of filtered water in a plastic jug, a mesh bag of Burmese peanuts, and 5 individually sealed portions of Big Ginza freeze-dried soup, all she'd been able to find in the kitchen. Slick had 2 sleeping bags, the flashlight, and a ball-peen hammer. It was quiet now. Just the sounds of the wind across corrugated metal and the scuff of their boots on concrete. He wasn't sure where he'd go himself. He thought he'd take Cherry as far as Marvie's place and leave her there. Then maybe he'd come back, see what was happening with Gentry. She could get a ride out to a Rust Belt town in a day or two. She didn't know that, though. All she could think about was leaving. Seemed as scared of having to watch Bobby the Count die on his stretcher as she was of the men outside. But Slick could see that Bobby didn't care much at all about dying. Maybe he figured he'd just be in there, like that 3 Jane. Or maybe he just didn't give a shit. Sometimes people got that way. If he meant to leave for good, he thought, steering Cherry through the dark with his free hand, he'd go in now and have a last look at the judge and the witch, the corpse grinder and the 2 investigators. But this way he'd get Cherry out, then come back. But he knew as he thought it that it didn't make sense. There wasn't time, but he'd get her out anyway. "There's a gap, this side, low down by the floor," he told her. "We'll slide out through there. Hope nobody notices." She squeezed his hand as he led her through the darkness. He found the hole by feel, stuffed the sleeping bags through, stuck the ball peen into his belt, lay down on his back, and pulled himself out until his head and chest were through. The sky was low and only marginally lighter than Factory's dark. He thought he heard a faint drumming of engines, but then it faded. He worked himself the rest of the way out with his heels and hips and shoulders, then rolled over in the snow. Something bumped against his foot, Cherry pushing out the water jug. He reached back to take it, and the red firefly lit on the back of his hand. He jerked back and rolled again as the bullet slammed Factory's wall like a giant's sledge. A white flare drifting above the solitude,
faint through the low cloud, drifting down from the swollen gray flank of the cargo drone, Bobby's diversion, illuminating the second hover, 30 meters out, and the hooded figure with the rifle. The first container struck the ground with a crash just in front of the hover and burst, throwing up a cloud of foam packing pellets. The second one, carrying 2 refrigerators, scored a direct hit, crushing the cab. The hijacked Borg Ward airship continued to disgorge containers as the flare spun down, fading. Slick scrambled back through the gap in the wall, leaving the water in the sleeping bags. Moving fast in the dark. He'd lost Cherry. He'd lost the hammer. She must have slid back into factory when the guy fired his first shot. Last shot if he'd been under that box when it came down. His feet found the ramp into the room where his machines waited. Cherry? He flicked on the flashlight. The one-armed judge was centered in the beam. Before the judge stood a figure with mirrors for eyes, throwing back the light. You want to die? A woman's voice. No. Light. Out. Darkness. Run. I can see in the dark. You just stuck that flash in your jacket pocket. You look like you still want to run. I got a gun on you. Run? Don't even think about it. You ever see a Fujiwara H.E. Flechette? Hits something hard, it goes off. Hits something soft, like most of you, buddy. It goes in, then it goes off. 10 seconds later. Why? So you get to think about it. You with those guys outside? No. You drop all those stoves and shit on them? No. Newmark. Bobby Newmark. I cut a deal tonight. I get somebody together with Bobby Newmark. I get my slate cleaned. You gonna show me where he is? 39. Too much. What kind of place was this, anyway? Things had gotten to a point where Mona couldn't get any comfort out of imagining Lynette's advice. Put Lynette in this situation, Mona figured she'd just eat more Memphis Black till she felt like it wasn't her problem. The world hadn't ever had so many moving parts or so few labels. They'd driven all night, with Angie mostly out of it. Mona could definitely credit the drug stories now. And talking. Different languages. Different voices. And that was the worst, those voices, because they spoke to Molly, challenged her, and she answered them back as she drove. Not like she was talking to Angie just to calm her down, but like there really was something there. Another person, at least 3 of them, speaking through Angie. And it hurt Angie when they spoke, made her muscles knot and her nose bleed, while Mona crouched over her and dabbed away the blood, filled with a weird mixture of fear and love and pity for the queen of all her dreams. Or maybe it was just the whiz. But in the blue-white flicker of freeway lights, Mona had seen her own hand beside Angie's, and they weren't the same. Not the same. Not really the same shape. And that had made her glad. The first voice had come when they'd been driving south, after Molly'd brought Angie in the copter. That one had just hissed and croaked and said something over and over about New Jersey and numbers on a map. About 2 hours after that, Molly'd slid the hover across a rest area and said they were in New Jersey. Then she'd gotten out and made a call from a frosty pay booth, a long one. When she'd climbed back in, Mona'd seen her skim a phone card out across the frozen slush, just throwing it away. And Mona'd asked her who she'd called, and she'd said England. Mona'd seen Molly's hand, then, on the wheel, how the dark nails had little yellowish flecks, like you got when you snapped off a set of artificials. She ought to get some solvent for that, Mona thought. Somewhere over a river they'd left the highway. Trees and fields and 2-lane blacktop, sometimes a lonely red light high up on some kind of tower. And that was when the other voices had come. And then it was back and forth, back and forth. The voices, and then Molly, and then the voices. And what it reminded her of was Eddie trying to do a deal. Except Molly was a lot better at it than Eddie. Even if she couldn't understand it, she could tell Molly was getting close to what she wanted. But she couldn't stand it when the voices came. It made her want to press herself back as far from Angie as she could get. The worst one was called Sam Eddie, something like that. What they all wanted was for Molly to take Angie somewhere for what they called a marriage. And Mona wondered if maybe Robin Lanier was in it somewhere. Like, what if Angie and Robin were going to get married, and this was all just some kind of wild thing stars did to get married? But she couldn't get that one to work, and every time this Sam Eddy voice came back, Mona's scalp would crawl. She could tell what Molly was bargaining for, though. She wanted her record cleaned up. Wiped. She'd watched this vid once with Lynette about this girl had 10, 12 personalities that would come out. Like, one was this shy little kid, and another'd just be this total bone addict slut. But it hadn't ever said anything about how any of those personalities could wipe your slate with the police. Then this flatland in their headlights, blown with snow, low ridges the color of rust, where the wind had torn away the white. The hover had one of those map screens you saw in cabs, or if a truck driver picked you up, but Molly never turned it on except that first time, to look for the numbers the voice had given her. After a while, Mona understood that Angie was telling her which way to go, or anyway, those voices were telling her. Mona'd been wishing for morning for a long time, but it was still night when Molly killed the lights and sped on through the dark. "Lights!" Angie cried. "Relax," Molly said, and Mona remembered how she'd moved in the dark in Gerald's. But the hover slowed slightly, swung into a long curve, shuddering over the rough ground. The dash lights blinked off, all the instrumentation. "Not a sound now, okay?" The hover accelerated through the dark, shifting white glare high up. Through the window, Mona glimpsed a drifting, twirling point. Above it, something else, bulbous and gray. "Down! Get her down!" Mona yanked at the catch on Angie's seatbelt as something whanged against the side of the hover, got her down on the floor and hugged her furs around her as Molly slewed left, sideswiping something Mona never saw. Mona looked up. Split-second flash of a big raggedy black building, a single white bulb lit above open warehouse doors, and then they were through, the turbine screaming full reverse. Crash! "I just don't know," the voice said, and Mona thought, "Well, I know how that is." Then the voice started to laugh and didn't stop, and the laugh became an on-off, on-off sound that wasn't laughter anymore. And Mona opened her eyes. Girl there with a tiny little flashlight, the kind Lynette kept on her big bunch of keys. Mona saw her in the weak back glare, the cone of light on Angie's slack face. Then she saw Mona looking, and the sound stopped. "Who the fuck are you?" The light in Mona's eyes. Cleveland voice, tough little fox face under raggy bleach blonde hair. "Mona, who are you?" But then she saw the hammer. "Cherry." "What's that hammer?" This Cherry looked at the hammer. "Somebody's after me and Slick." She looked at Mona again. "You them?" "I don't think so." "You look like her." The light jabbing at Angie. "Not my hands. Anyway, I didn't used to." "You both look like Angie Mitchell." "Yeah. She is." Cherry gave a little shiver. She was wearing 3 or 4 leather jackets she'd gotten off different boyfriends. That was a Cleveland thing. "Unto this high castle," came the voice from Angie's mouth, thick as mud, and Cherry banged her head against the roof of the cab, dropping her hammer. "My horse is come." In the wavering beam of Cherry's keyring flashlight, they saw the muscles of Angie's face crawling beneath the skin. "Why do you linger here, little sisters, now that her marriage is arranged?" Angie's face relaxed, became her own, as a thin, bright trickle of blood descended from her left nostril. She opened her eyes, wincing in the light. "Where is she?" she asked Mona. "Gone," Mona said. "Told me to stay here with you." "Who?" Cherry asked. "Molly," Mona said. "She was driving." Cherry wanted to find somebody called Slick. Mona wanted Molly to come back and tell her what to do, But Cherry was antsy about staying down here on the ground floor, she said, because there were these people outside with guns. Mona remembered that sound, something hitting the hover. She got Cherry's light and went back there. There was a hole she could just stick her finger into, halfway up the right side, and a bigger one, two fingers, on the left side. Cherry said they'd better get upstairs, where Slick probably was, before those people decided to come in here. Mona wasn't sure. "Come on," Cherry said. "Slick's probably back up there with Gentry and the Count." "What did you just say?" And it was Angie Mitchell's voice, just like in the Stims. Whatever this was, it was cold as hell when they got out of the hover. Mona's legs were bare, but dawn was coming, finally. She could make out faint rectangles that were probably windows, just a gray glow. The girl called Cherry was leading them somewhere, she said upstairs, navigating with little blinks of the keyring light, Angie close behind her, and Mona bringing up the rear. Mona caught the toe of her shoe in something that rustled. Bending to free herself, she found what felt like a plastic bag. Sticky. Small, hard things inside. Took a deep breath and straightened up, shoving the bag into the side pocket of Michael's jacket. Then they were climbing these narrow stairs, steep, almost a ladder, Angie's fur brushing Mona's hand on the rough cold railings. Then a landing, then a turn, another set of stairs, another landing. A draft blew from somewhere. "It's kind of a bridge," Cherry said. "Just walk across it quick, okay? 'Cause it kind of moves." And not expecting this, any of it, not the high white room, the sagging shelves stuffed with ragged, faded books, she thought of the old man, the clutter of console things with cables twisting everywhere, not this skinny, burning-eyed man in black with his hair trained back into the crest they called a fighting fish in Cleveland, not his laugh when he saw them there, or the dead guy. Mona'd seen dead people before, enough to know it when she saw it, the color of it. Sometimes in Florida somebody'd lie down on a cardboard pallet on the sidewalk outside the squat, just not get up. Clothes and skin gone the color of sidewalk anyway, but still different when they'd kicked. Another color under that. White truck came then. Eddie said because if you didn't, they'd swell up, like Mona'd seen a cat once, blown up like a basketball, turned on its back, legs and tail sticking out stiff as boards, and that made Eddie laugh. And this whiz artist laughing now. Mona knew those kind of eyes. And Cherry making this kind of groaning sound, and Angie just standing there. "Okay, everybody," she heard someone say. Molly, and turned to find her there, in the open door, with a little gun in her hand, and this big, dirty-haired guy beside her, looking stupid as a box of rocks. "Just stand there till I sort you out." The skinny guy just laughed. "Shut up," Molly said, like she was thinking about something else. She shot without even looking at the gun. Blue flash on the wall beside his head, and Mona couldn't hear anything but her ears ringing. Skinny guy curled in a knot on the floor, head between his knees. Angie walking toward the stretcher where the dead guy lay, his eyes just white. Slow, slow, like she was moving underwater, and this look on her face. Mona's hand in her jacket pocket was sort of figuring something out all by itself. Sort of squeezing that Ziploc she'd picked up downstairs, telling her it had whiz in it. She pulled it out, and it did, sticky with drying blood, three crystals inside and some kind of derm. She didn't know why she'd pulled it out right then, except that nobody was moving. The guy with the fighting fish had sat up, but he just stayed there. Angie was over by the stretcher, where she didn't seem to be looking at the dead guy, but at this gray box stuck up over his head on a kind of frame. Cherry from Cleveland had got her back up against the wall of books and was sort of jamming her knuckles into her mouth. The big guy just stood there beside Molly, who had her head cocked to the side like she was listening for something. Mona couldn't stand it. Table had a steel top, big hunk of old metal there, holding down a dusty stack of printout. Snapped the three yellow crystals down like buttons in a row, picked up that metal hunk, and one, two, three, banged them into powder. That did it. Everybody looked, except Angie.
"Excuse me,"
Mona heard herself say, as she swept the mound of rough yellow powder into the waiting palm of her left hand. "How it is?" She buried her nose in the pile and snorted. "Sometimes," she added, and snorted the rest. Nobody said anything. And it was the still center again, just like that time before. So fast it was standing still. Rapture. Rapture's coming. So fast, so still, she could put a sequence to what happened next. This big laugh, ha ha, like it wasn't really a laugh, through a loudspeaker, past the door, from out on the catwalk thing. And Molly just turns, smooth as silk, quick but like there's no hurry in it, and the little gun snicks like a lighter. Then there's this blue flash outside, and the big guy gets sprayed with blood from out there, as old metal tears loose, and Cherry's screaming before the catwalk thing hits with this big complicated sound. Dark floor down there, where she found the whiz in its bloody bag. "Gentry," someone says, and she sees it's a little vid on the table, young guy's face on it. Jack Slick's control unit now. They're in the building. Guy with the fighting fish scrambles up and starts to do things with wires and consoles. And Mona could just watch, because she was so still, and it was all interesting stuff. How the big guy gives this bellow and rushes over, shouting how they're his, how the face on the screen says, "Slick, come on, you don't need 'em anymore." And this engine starts up, somewhere downstairs, and Mona hears this clanking and rattling, and then somebody yelling down there. And sun's coming in the tall, skinny window now, so she moves over there for a look. And there's something out there, kind of a truck or hover, only it's buried under this pile of what looks like refrigerators, brand new refrigerators, and broken hunks of plastic crates. And there's somebody in a camo suit, lying down with his face in the snow. And out past that, there's another hover, looks like it's all burned up. It's interesting. 40. Pink Satin. Angela Mitchell comprehends this room and its inhabitants through shifting data planes that represent viewpoints, though of whom or what she is in most cases in doubt. There is a considerable degree of overlap, of contradiction. The man with the ragged crest of hair, in black beaded leather, is Thomas Trail Gentry, as birth data and sin digits cascade through her, of no fixed address, as a different facet informs her that this room is his. Past a gray wash of official data traces, faintly marbled with the Fission authorities' repeated pink suspicions of utilities fraud, she finds him in a different light. He is like one of Bobby's cowboys. Though young, he is like the old men of the Gentleman Loser. He is an autodidact, an eccentric, obsessed, by his own lights, a scholar. He is mad, a night runner, guilty, in Maman's view, in Legba's, of manifold heresies. Lady 3 Jane, in her own eccentric scheme, has filed him under Rimbaud. Another face flares out at Angie from Rimbaud. His name is Riviera, a minor player in the dreams. Molly has deliberately stunned him, causing an explosive flechette to detonate 18 centimeters from his skull. Molly, like the girl Mona, is sinless, her birth unregistered. Yet around her name, names, swarm galaxies of supposition, rumor, conflicting data. Street girl, prostitute, bodyguard, assassin, she mingles on the manifold planes with the shadows of heroes and villains whose names mean nothing to Angie, though their residual images have long since been woven through the global culture. And this too belonged to 3 Jane, and now belongs to Angie. Molly has just killed a man, has fired one of the explosive flechettes into his throat. His collapse against a steel railing, suffering metal fatigue, has caused a large section of catwalk to tumble to the floor below. This room has no other entrance, a fact of some strategic importance. It was probably not Molly's intention to cause the collapse of the catwalk. She sought to prevent the man, a hired mercenary, from using his weapon of choice, a short alloy shotgun coated with a black non-reflective finish. Nonetheless, Gentry's loft is now effectively isolated. Angie understands Molly's importance to 3 Jane, the source of her desire for and rage at her. Knowing this, she sees all the banality of human evil. Angie sees Molly restlessly prowling a gray winter London, a young girl at her side, and knows, without knowing how she knows, that this same girl is now at 23 Margate Road, SW2. Continuity? The girl's father was previously the master of the man Swain, who had lately become 3 Jane's servant for the sake of the information she provides to those who do her bidding. As has Robin Lanier, of course, though he waits to be paid in a different coin. For the girl Mona, Angie feels a peculiar tenderness, a pity, a degree of envy. Though Mona has been altered to resemble Angie as closely as possible, Mona's life has left virtually no trace on the fabric of things, and represents, in Legba's system, the nearest thing to innocence. Cherry Lee Chesterfield is surrounded by a sad, ragged scrawl, her information profile like a child's drawing, citations for vagrancy, petty debts, an aborted career as a paramedical technician grade 6, framing birth data and sin. Slick, or Slick Henry, is among the sinless, but 3 Jane, Continuity, Bobby, all have lavished their attention on him. For 3 Jane, he serves as the focus of a minor node of association. She equates his ongoing rite of construction, his cathartic response to chemopenal trauma, with her own failed attempts to exorcise the barren dream of Tessier Ashpool. In the corridors of 3 Jane's memory, Angie has frequently come upon the chamber where a spider-armed manipulator stirs the refuse of Straylight's brief clotted history, an act of extended collage. And Bobby provides other memories, tapped from the artist as he accessed 3 Jane's library of Babel, his slow, sad, childlike labor on the plane called Dog Solitude, erecting anew the forms of pain and memory. Down in the chill dark of factory's floor, one of Slick's kinetic sculptures, controlled by a sub-program of Bobby's, removes the left arm of another mercenary, employing a mechanism salvaged 2 summers before from a harvesting machine of Chinese manufacture. The mercenary, whose name and sin boil past Angie like hot silver bubbles, dies with his cheek against one of Little Bird's boots. Only Bobby, of all the people in this room, is not here as Data. And Bobby is not the wasted thing before her, strapped down in alloy and nylon, its chin filmed with dried vomit, nor the eager, familiar face gazing out at her from a monitor on Gentry's workbench. Is Bobby the solid, rectangular mass of memory bolted above the stretcher? Now she steps across rolling dunes of soiled pink satin, under a tooled steel sky, free at last of the room and its Data. Brigitte walks beside her, and there is no pressure, no hollow of night, no hive sound. There are no candles. Continuity is there, too, represented by a strolling scribble of silver tinsel that reminds her somehow of Hilton Swift on the beach at Malibu. "Feeling better?" Brigitte asks. "Much better, thank you." "I thought so." "Why is Continuity here?" "Because he is your cousin, built from mass biochips. Because he is young. We walk with you to your wedding." "But who are you, Brigitte? What are you really?" "I am the message your father was told to write. I am the veve he drew in your head." Brigitte leans close. "Be kind to Continuity. He fears that in his clumsiness, he has earned your displeasure." The tinsel scribble scoots off before them, across the satin dunes, to announce the bride's arrival. 41. Mr. Yanaka. The mass neotech unit was still warm to the touch. The white plastic pad beneath it was discolored as if by heat. A smell like burning hair. She watched the bruises on Tick's face darken. He'd sent her to a bedside cabinet for a worn tin cigarette box filled with pills and dermadiscs, had torn his collar open and pressed three of the adhesive discs against skin white as porcelain. She helped him fashion a sling from a length of optic cable.
But Colin said she had forgotten.
I haven't, he said, and sucked air between his teeth, working the sling beneath his arm. Seemed to happen at the time. Lingers a bit. He winced.
I'm sorry.
It's okay. Sally told me. About your mother, I mean.
Yes.
She didn't look away.
She killed herself. In Tokyo.
Whoever she was, that wasn't her.
The unit.
She glanced toward the breakfast table. She burnt it. Won't matter to him, though. He's still there. Has the run of it. What's our Sally up to, then?
She has Angela Mitchell with her. She's gone to find the thing that all that comes from. Where we were. A place called New Jersey.
The telephone rang. Kumiko's father, head and shoulders, on the broad screen behind Tick's telephone. He wore his dark suit, his Rolex watch, a galaxy of small fraternal devices in his lapel. Kumiko thought he looked very tired, tired and very serious, a serious man behind the smooth dark expanse of desk in his study. Seeing him there, she regretted that Sally hadn't phoned from a booth with a camera. She would very much have liked to see Sally again. Now, perhaps, it would be impossible.
You look well, Kumiko, her father said.
Kumiko sat up very straight, facing the small camera mounted just below the wall screen. In reflex, she summoned her mother's mask of disdain, but it would not come. Confused, she dropped her gaze to where her hands lay folded in her lap. She was abruptly aware of Tick, of his embarrassment, his fear, trapped in the chair beside her, in full view of the camera. You were correct to flee Swain's house, her father said. She met his eyes again.
He is your kobun.
No longer. While we were distracted here with our own difficulties, he formed new and dubious alliances, pursuing courses of which we could not approve.
And your difficulties, father?
Was there the flicker of a smile?
All that is ended. Order and accord are again established.
Excuse me, sir, Mr. Yanaka, Tick began, then seemed to lose his voice altogether.
Yes? And you are?
Tick's bruised face contorted in a huge and particularly lugubrious wink.
His name is Tick, father. He has sheltered and protected me, along with with the Mass Neotech unit. He saved my life tonight.
Really?
I had not been informed of this. I was under the impression that you had not left his apartment.
Something cold. How?
She asked, sitting forward.
How could you know?
The Mass Neotech unit broadcast your destination once it was known, once the unit was clear of Swain's systems. We dispatched watchers to the area. She remembered the noodle seller. Without, of course, informing Swain. But the unit never broadcast a second message.
It was broken. An accident.
Yet you say it saved your life.
Sir, Tick said, you'll pardon me. What I mean is, am I covered?
Covered?
Protected. From Swain, I mean, and his bent SB friends and the rest.
Swain is dead.
There was a silence.
But somebody will be running it, surely. The fancy, I mean. Your business.
Mr. Yanaka regarded Tick with frank curiosity.
Of course. How else might order and accord be expected to continue?
Give him your word, father, Kumiko said, that he will come to no harm.
Yanaka looked from Kumiko to the grimacing Tick.
I extend profound gratitude to you, sir, for having protected my daughter. I am in your debt.
Iri, Kumiko said.
Christ, Tick said, overcome with awe. Fucking fancy that.
Father, Kumiko said, on the night of my mother's death, Did you order the secretaries to allow her to leave alone?
Her father's face was very still. She watched it fill with a sorrow she had never seen before. No, he said at last. I did not. Tick coughed.
Thank you, father. Will I be returning to Tokyo now?
Certainly, if you wish. Though I understand you have been allowed to see very little of London. My associate will soon arrive at Mr. Tick's apartment. If you wish to remain, to explore the city, he will arrange this.
Thank you, father.
Goodbye, Kumi. And he was gone. Now then, Tick said, wincing horribly as he extended his good arm, help me up from this.
But you require medical attention.
Don't I, then? He'd managed to get to his feet and was hobbling toward the toilet when Petal opened the door from the dark upstairs hall. If you've broken my bloody lock, Tick said, you'd better pay me for it. Sorry, Petal said, blinking. I've come for Miss Yanaka. Too bad, mate. Just had her dad on the phone. Told us Swain's been topped. Told us he's sending round the new boss. He smiled crookedly, triumphantly. But you see, Petal said gently, that's me. 42. Factory floor. Cherry's still screaming. Somebody shut her up, Molly says, where she's standing by the door with her little gun, and Mona thinks she can do that, and pass Cherry a little of her stillness, where everything's interesting and nothing's pushing too hard. But on the way across the room, she sees the crumpled ziplock on the floor, and remembers there's a derm in there, maybe something that'll help Cherry calm down. Here, she says, when she gets to her, peels the backing off and sticks the derm on the side of Cherry's neck. Cherry's scream slides down the scale into a gurgle as she sinks down the face of old books, but Mona's sure she'll be okay. And anyway, there's shooting downstairs, guns. Out past Molly, a white tracer goes racketing and wanging around steel girders, and Molly's yelling at Gentry, can he turn the goddamn lights on? That had to mean the lights downstairs, because the lights up here were plenty bright, so bright she can see fuzzy little beads, traces of color streaming off things if she looks close. Tracers. That's what you call those bullets, the ones that light up. Eddie'd told her that in Florida, looking down the beach to where some private security was shooting them off in the dark. Yeah, lights, the face on the little screen said. The witch can't see. Mona smiled at him. She didn't think anybody else had heard. Witch? So Gentry and Big Slick were tearing around yanking these fat yellow wires off the wall, where they'd been stuck with silver tape, and plugging them together with these metal boxes. And Cherry from Cleveland was sitting on the floor with her eyes closed, and Molly was crouched down by the door, holding her gun with both hands, and Angie was, be still. She heard somebody say that, but it was nobody in the room. She thought maybe it was Lynette, like Lynette could just say that through time, through the stillness, because Angie was just there, down on the floor beside the dead guy's stretcher. Her legs folded under her like a statue, her arms around him. End of side 6. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.